Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you once again for coming out this evening. And this is going to be part three of our four-part series, looking at the Covenanders in Collibaki, but within the broader context of the story of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in general in Ireland. Before I start, I would just make a few comments that next week will, of course, be the final one, and we're hoping to have up the Covenanders in Ulster banners. The exhibition banners, we'll have those up in the hall. And again, they present the story, I suppose, going back to Scotland and coming up to the present day, but very much focusing on the 17th century story. During the summer, those banners will be on display in Mid Antrim Museum. We've been given the opportunity to put them on display there. And a special banner will be prepared specifically looking at the formation of the first Irish Presbytery, something I'm going to be speaking on tonight. There'll also be a tour of Covenanter sites in Mid Antrim on the 31st of July. So it's visiting places like the Laymore, the Peden Monument, Kelswater, and of course Collibaki. And I mentioned that next week, if anybody wants to bring along some sort of object or an item or a letter or anything at all that is in some way connected to not simply even Collibaki, but some of the any of the Covenanter congregations around, please do so. We'd love to see what may be found. Just last night I was shown the communion ware of the now closed Reformed Presbyterian Church at Garva. That has survived. And it's been presented now to the church and is going to be on display up at the library and bookshop in Knockbracken. Now, where I left off rather last week was with the ordination of the Reverend William Martin at the Vow near Risharkin on the 2nd of July 1757. He was ordained minister, the first Covenanter minister ordained in Ireland. In 1760, Martin chose to settle himself, base himself at Kelswater, and there a former mill building was converted to a meeting house, the earliest meeting house of the Covenanters in Ireland. At that time there was a division of the Covenanters in Ireland into two congregations. Martin chose the Antrim congregation, the Antrim meeting as it was known. And the other congregation, I think it's very hard to tell because we simply don't have records of the time, but I think the other congregation would have been over in the west of the province, focused on the Foyle Valley, taking in the city of Derry, Donegal, part of North Tyrone as well. But Martin focused his ministry on what was known as the Antrim congregation and used Kelswater as his base. Now, Martin ministered here for nearly a dozen years. But in 1771, he decides to go to America and take as many of his congregation with him as possible. That has, of course, major repercussions for the church, but we shouldn't see it as being, by any means, the end of the story. Now, before we get on to that, let's look at this man, the Reverend Matthew Lynn. He was from Cairncastle, Quatermain at Cairncastle, born in 1731, a graduate of Glasgow University, licensed at Carnatz on the 26th of July 1761. Well, that's probably Kelswater, because Kelswater, the RP Church of Kelswater, is in the townland of Carnatz. Spent the next 2 years as an itinerant preacher, but on the 21st of August 1763, he's ordained minister of a newly formed Banside congregation. So now we have three congregations. We have the Antrim congregation, we have the congregation out in the west, and we have the Banside congregation. And his ministry would have covered most of what is County Londonderry. So it would have been the congregations that are now at, for example, Ballynagan, Drumbog, even Limavady. That would have been the focus of his ministry. Martin was, as I said, ordained in 1763, and ordained at the Vow, the same place where William Martin was ordained 6 years before. And the Vow, as you can see from the map, you can see the A on the lower map. It's near Risharkin, just south of Ballymoney. On the aerial photograph, I don't know if you can see, but the road saying the Vow Road You can see a circular area near the river. That's the old graveyard at the Vow. And the site was chosen because it was near the location of a ferry crossing the Bann. So it was easy to reach for people coming from County Londonderry side and for people coming up from parts of County Antrim. So it was a traditional crossing of the river and an easy meeting place for Covenanters in Londonderry and Antrim. With the ordination of Lynn, there were now two Covenanter ministers in Ireland. And that meant that a presbytery could be formed. Now, we don't know exactly when it was formed. There's no authentic record of it in Ireland. We don't have the minutes of the first Reformed Presbytery, unfortunately. Recently, I was in Edinburgh, and I looked in the National Archives at the minutes of the Scottish Reformed Presbytery, but unfortunately, there is no mention in it of the Irish Reformed Presbytery. The assumption is that it probably met immediately after Lynn was ordained. So Lynn was ordained, and immediately after that, on the same day probably, they formed the first Irish presbytery. So, now there is a infrastructure to the church in Ireland. It's not simply one man who's covering a vast area. Now there are two ministers who can split the burden between them, and they've got a structure in place. They have a presbytery in place. So this is a major step forward in the story of the Covenanters in Ireland. Now we have a presbytery, one of the basic structures within the Presbyterian system. Now, I mentioned that Martin is at Kelswater for around about 12 years, but in late 1771, he decides to go to America. And as I've said, he tries to encourage as many of his own congregation to go with him. And the interesting thing is, we can actually follow this story through the pages of the Belfast Newsletter. Belfast Newsletter, founded in 1737. And through a series of notices and adverts, we can see what actually happens. This first advert appears on the last day of the year 1771. It says that the Reverend Mr. William Martin of Kelswater, County of Antrim, having frequently heard of the great distress many are in for want of gospel ordinances dispensed them in South Carolina, and being frequently urged and pressed by many of his hearers and acquaintances to go there, he has at last firmly resolved, God willing, to be ready to embark at Belfast or Larne for thence, about the beginning of September next, so September 1772. Therefore he thinks proper to give his public notice of his present or former hearers, or any other well-disposed families that have a design to embrace this favourable opportunity, to go to a country where they may enjoy the comforts of life in abundance with the free exercise of their religious sentiments. So in other words, if they went to America, this would be an opportunity to improve both their material and their spiritual circumstances. See, you must remember that this was the era of in which there was an Anglican ascendancy. Presbyterians were under various disabilities. For example, it wasn't legal for a Presbyterian minister to conduct a marriage between a member of his own church and a member of the Church of Ireland. That restriction did not end even until 1844. There was a resentment at being barred from what you might call the levers of power by this Anglican establishment. And for Covenanters in particular, because they were a minority within a minority, they especially felt aggrieved at the situation they found themselves in. So to go to America looked like it would present an opportunity to make a fresh start in somewhere that they would have freedom of religion. We found another advert in late May 1772. And this indicates that by this time, Martin had actually agreed with John Montgomery to have a stout, commodious ship ready to sail from Larne on the 15th of August next. And he says, Martin, who has already agreed for a considerable number of passengers, Thomas Barclay at Ballymena, or John Montgomery at Larne were those to speak to about taking passage on this ship. That's dated the 23rd of May 1772. So he's gathering up passengers for this voyage to America. Mid-July, Martin puts his farm up for sale. This is the advert for that. To be sold by auction on Tuesday the 4th of August next at Kelswater, the parish of Connor, to the highest bidder, a lease of, I think it says, two lives belonging to the Reverend William Martin. He has 20 acres, excellent ground, highly improved, pleasantly situated by the River Kells, with a dwelling house and office houses, and so on. So basically he's selling everything, selling the house, selling the farm, he's selling his furniture, his crops, his cattle, all must go. This is it, he's on his way, and he's not coming back. So that's dated at Kelswater on the 8th of July, 1772. And then from the 9th of October 1772, we see here a notice about the ship sailing the Lord Dunluce that sailed from Larne with the Reverend William Martin with near 400 other passengers, all in high spirits. The owners of said ship take this opportunity to do justice to the character of Mr. Martin, which has been maliciously aspersed, and declare that he punctually fulfilled all his engagements, both with them and the passengers, and acquitted himself in the whole transaction as a man of honesty and a minister of the gospel. So it seems to be that there was some malicious gossip going around about Martin, what he was really intending, and this notice is very much a declaration that he was doing everything in complete honesty and transparency. We know the ship arrived in Charleston in South Carolina at the end of 1772, in December 1772. And in commemoration of Martin, his ordination at the vow and his voyage to America, we have this memorial stone placed at the vow, just placed at the entrance to the graveyard. So it refers to the fact that he preached faithfully across Ulster and in this place until October 1772, when he emigrated with 460 families for the New World in the Americas, landed in South Carolina in December 1772 and established numerous new congregations. There is some thinking, or there's some thoughts that he maybe didn't take quite as many people as is sometimes claimed, but it is generally believed that of the 400 or so passengers on board the ship Lord Dunluce, on which he sailed, most of those would have been members of his own congregation. And when you think of it, to remove 400 people from a congregation, that's a substantial body of people leaving and going to America, and that would have had, of course, major repercussions for the congregation back here. Now, in America, Martin made quite a name for himself. He preached in a number of places. The first place, or one of the first places he preached in, up in the top right, was a church called the Catholic Presbyterian Church. And if that doesn't sound like an oxymoron, I don't know what is. But that was the name of the church. It was called the Catholic Presbyterian Church because it was a meeting place for Presbyterians of all different shades of opinion. So Presbyterians, Reformed Presbyterians, Seceders, or whatever, they all could use this meeting house for their services. Martin also had his own meeting house built for him by Covenanters in South Carolina. And you can see the stone on the left-hand side. It says that, erected for William Martin in 1773, it was here in 1780 he preached the patriotic sermon that stirred the surrounding country into action. His church and home were burned, and he was made a prisoner by the British. Erected by Mary Adair Chapter, D.A.R., that's Daughters of the American Revolution. They're ladies who claim direct descent from someone who fought in the American Revolutionary War, that was erected August 1742. You see, to begin with, the American War of Independence was felt by many of the Scotch-Irish in the backcountry to be really none of their business. And it wasn't until a particular incident of some severity in their area that it really hit home to them that they must take some action. And the Sunday after that incident, Martin is supposed to have preached a particularly fervent sermon in which he actually called for action. He said that they could no longer stand back, that they had to take up arms and fight their cause. He was, as the sign says, arrested, the erected sign says he was arrested, and imprisoned for a time, but later released. And you can see the stone on the bottom right-hand corner, Reverend William Martin, Covenanter preacher and revolutionary patriot. Born in Ireland 1729, died in Chester District 1807, and again, erected by the Mary Adair chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution in 1936, I think that says. So Martin certainly, in his new country, had a major impact and was at the forefront of the cause of the colonists during the American War of Independence in the Carolina backcountry. Back to Ireland. Looking at some of the early ministers, well, I've mentioned Martin already. He immigrates to America in 1772. Matthew Lynn, who'd been ordained in 1763, he immigrates to America in the following year, 1773. In 1765, William James is ordained the first minister of the congregation in the Foyle Valley, and that's the beginnings of the congregation at Brady. He ministers there for 14 years. He dies in 1779. Daniel McClelland was ordained at the Laymore in 1765. He immigrates to America the following year. Thomas Hamilton, ordained in 1770. He ministers at Fohan, dies 1779. Alexander Dobbin, ordained in 1772, goes to America 1773. William Staveley, I'll mention in more detail in a moment, 1772. He outlasts all of them, dies in 1825. And finally then, Samuel Aiken, ordained 1776 and dies in 1798. Nothing to do with the rebellion of 1798, he just happens to die in that year. Aiken is from near Clough, just north of Ballymena. So as a result of these numerous changes in the ministers of the Covenanter Church, unfortunately the Reformed Presbytery in Ireland is forced to dissolve in 1779. It's a combination of the emigration of ministers with the deaths of William James and Thomas Hamilton in that year. So unfortunately the Irish Reformed Presbytery ends. First one ends in 1779. And instead what happens is that the church is once again taken back under the supervision of the parent church in Scotland. Now looking specifically at Collibaci, we have an interesting account of a man called Robert Young from Scotland who set sail for America under the auspices of the Scottish Presbytery. To work in America among the Covenanters there. He doesn't reach America. He is shipwrecked off the Antrim coast. Understandably, he's quite reluctant to get back on board another ship, and so he moves inland, ends up in Collibaci, and is shown hospitality by the Rites of Craigs, who are some of whom are here tonight. So he's shown hospitality by the Wright family, and he marries a local woman, actually, a Miss Dixon from Collibaci. He offers his ministerial services in the Collibaci area for a number of years before he goes across to Donegal, and he works in the Remelton, East Donegal area for a number of years. He eventually dies, and he's buried in the Glendermot Church of Ireland graveyard just outside Londonderry. Then we have William Gibson, He's from Knockbracken. He's not born into a Covenanter family, but through the influence of a Covenanter minister, he joins the denomination, trained for the ministry, and he is ordained minister of the Antrim congregation, in other words, Cullibackie and Kelswater, in 1787. So what you could say is that Cullibackie has now become a congregation. We can't put a precise date on when Cullibackie actually became a congregation, but certainly by this time, Cullibackie is recognised as a congregation. So you could Cullibackie and Kelswater under, you might say, the umbrella of the broader Antrim congregation. I showed this slide last week of the round hole at Laymore, a traditional meeting place for the Covenanters. And this would have been where, to begin with, at any rate, Gibson ministered, where he preached. It may even have been where he was ordained. Certainly this was the traditional meeting place for the Covenanters of Cullibackie. But in 1789, a meeting house is built here in Cullibackie on this site. This is the first purpose-built meeting house for the Covenanters in Cullibackie, and it was erected 1779. That's a drawing of it as it looked in the 1850s, but it probably hadn't changed a great deal in the intervening period. You can see the outside staircase leading up to the gallery. You can see the entrance, the entrance porch and the gable. Now, the meeting house was built, said, here where we are now, and you can see up on the map Cullibackie as it looked in the 1830s, the first edition Ordnance Survey map, and you can see where the focus of the village is very much at that end of the main street. Where we are now, there's really no development at all. But you can see, just beside where it says Presbyterian Meeting House, obviously Reformed Presbyterian Meeting House, the pound where stray cattle were impounded until their owner claimed them. And that's given rise to the local name for the meeting house as the Pound Meeting House. But you can see very clearly the difference between, as William Shaw called it in his history of Cullibackie, the old Cullibackie and where we are now, new Cullibackie. Now, looking in more detail at William Stavely, he was, in a sense, a local man. He was from Furniskey, just outside Kells. His ancestor had come across from Yorkshire in the 1630s. And Stavely went on, studied, trained to be a Reformed Presbyterian minister, and was ordained at Conlig between Bangor and Newton Ards in 1772. He's minister of a congregation that is, you know, huge in its extent. It would have stretched from Donaghadee all the way to County Cavan. But in 1776 or thereabouts, he bases himself at Knockbracken. And he's regarded as the founder of numerous Reformed Presbyterian congregations, just to name a few: Newton Ards, Knockbracken, Dromore, Rathfryland, Ballylane, Fairview, Creva. So his ministry was huge and his influence was immense. And that's given rise to the description of him as the apostle of the Covenanters. James Seton Reed, in his History of the Presbyterian Church, praises Stavely and says, of this denomination, the Reverend William Stavely was the great apostle. Such was his influence. Now, Stavely did make a name for himself even from a fairly early stage in his ministry. He was the author of a book called Truth Restored, or The New Mode of Swearing Religious Oaths, published in Newry in 1775. You see, at that time, to swear an oath, say before a magistrate, you had to kiss the Bible. And Stavely argued very forcefully in this book that that was unscriptural. The scriptural way of swearing an oath was with an upraised hand. To kiss the Bible was not the way it should be done. And no doubt that would have brought him to the attention of the authorities. It was very much a direct challenge to the state in his arguments. So he was someone who would have been taken notice of, and someone no doubt considered as being of subversive tendencies. One indication of the way that Davy was coming to the attention of others was the fact that Covenanters were frequently coming under attack from other denominations. It's an indication of their growth, their expansion. And one interesting poem that I came across, I found it in one piece of secondary literature. I've never been able to track down the original in any of the major libraries in Britain or Ireland or America. But it's a satirical poem by William McCormack. It's called The Porciad, and it's about a fictional pig race. And Staveley is actually referred to in this poem in not very flattering terms. You can see it says, a gaping, gaunting, straight-haired Pharisee who from a tent with loud vociferation delivers church and state to dire damnation. Thus to his elect he roars and rants, he gapes and groans and lyingly he cants, so pig-like is he found of every lung, you'd swear that grunting was his mother tongue. One might say that Staveley, in his preaching style, would have been very direct, would have been very evangelical. This would probably not have gone down well with those who were of a more liberal strain. I see he was a target of attack for his preaching and for the impact he was making in his area. The poem by McCormack did produce a response in which Staveley is defended as a true defender of Zion. But it gives you an idea that the vitriol, you might say, that was directed against Staveley and no doubt other Covenanter ministers for their stand, I mean, delivers church and state to dire damnation. I mean, Staveley is arguing very strongly against those in positions of authority, the Anglican establishment. Now, in 1792, we see the revival of the Irish Reformed Presbytery. It's constituted in 1792, and those are the ministers who were there at its revival. So Staveley, Newton Ards and Knock Bracken, Aiken, Raff Ryland, Creva and Valley Lane, so like you might say South Down, Armagh going into Monaghan, McKinney, I'll mention in a moment, from of Dervock and Kilrats, Alexander, Samuel Alexander at Brady and Fohan, William Gamble, Letter Kenny and Ballygay. Ballygay is actually a forerunner of Milford, the Reformed Presbyterian congregation in Milford. And of course, William Gibson here at Kelswater and Cully Backey. So we've gone from a situation where they're forced to dissolve the presbytery to now, a mere 13 years later, where it can be revived in a much stronger position than it ever was before. Now in the 1790s, Covenanters were drawn into the revolutionary intrigue of the period. This was a period of immense politicisation in Irish history, and Covenanters were actually very much part of that. Now, there were several movements that they became involved in. First of all, the Volunteers. Well, the Volunteers had been established in the late 1770s to defend Ireland from invasion at a time when the regular army was in America fighting the colonists, fighting the Covenanters, among others. It became quite political in its objectives. It called for reform of Parliament and so on. But eventually it sort of died away towards the end of the 1780s. Then in the early 1790s, it revived again. And at least two Covenanter ministers became involved in the Volunteers. For example, a Drumbracklin Volunteer Corps was established in the Knock Bracken area. Drumbracklin was the name of the manor, but it takes in Knock Bracken. And the commandant was the local landlord, R.M.H. McNeill. And William Staveley was the captain, lieutenant and secretary of that volunteer corps. And a declaration was issued in July 1792, in which Staveley has his name appended. And it's very interesting just what it actually says. Among other things, it says, resolved that it is the natural and native right of man to learn the use of arms without infringing on the rights or properties of others. And to improve this right, we associate to learn the use of arms. Well, I think if William Staveley had been present at Wright's Farm a couple of months ago and had seen the Curragh of Culleybacky men shooting, he may not have been very impressed. Now, much more radical was the Society of United Irishmen that was formed in Belfast in 1791. The first branch formed in Belfast, 1791. And it was mainly composed of middle-class Presbyterians. Other branches were then formed in Dublin and other places in Ireland. And the United Irishmen called for parliamentary reform and an end to English interference in Irish affairs. It was government later came down very hard on it, after which the United Irishmen became much more radical, became an underground, oath-bound secret society that plans for insurrection. And there's great debate about, well, just how far did Covenanters go in becoming involved in it? In 1898, on the 100th anniversary of the rebellion, an article appeared in the Covenanter which basically said that, well, 1798 was really a Jesuit conspiracy and Covenanters had nothing to do with it. Well, that is a serious piece of historical revisionism that is certainly not an accurate reflection of the situation affecting the Covenanters and the United Irishmen. A contemporary piece of literature by two United Irishmen, two of the more moderate, you might say, United Irishmen to an extent, McNevin and Emmett, called Pieces of Irish History. And in it they write, of this perhaps no instance is more remarkable than can be conceived than the conduct of the Covenanters, a sect still numerous in those two counties, that is Antrim and Down. They were, however, lovers of liberty and republicans by religion and descent. Covenanters in numbers became United Irishmen and the most active promoters of the system. It's maybe a surprise now to think of the Covenanters being republican in their political outlook, but actually even late 17th century Scotland, there were Covenanters who wished to see the overthrow of the monarchy and a republic established in its stead. So certainly they were involved. To what extent, sometimes it's hard to work out because the documentation of the time doesn't necessarily survive to paint a true picture, but certainly they were involved. There's no doubt about that. We look at James McKinney. He was from either Cookstown or Kilray, the sources disagree, ordained at Kirkhills in 1783 as a minister of a congregation in North Antrim, the beginnings of the Kilrats and Dervock congregation. Organises a volunteer company at Dervock in 1792, and is accused of treason after preaching on the rights of God. There was a prevailing humanistic theory of the rights of man at this time, and as a direct challenge to that, McKinney preaches on the rights of God. But that's actually regarded by the authorities as an act of treason. So McKinney is forced to flee to America. He does so in 1793. And S.B. Wiley, who I'll mention more of in a moment, a young Covenanter from the Culleybacky area, later called him a most ardent patriot and republican, having no sympathy with British domination and Irish vassalage. Now that would have been written long afterwards and written in an American context, but Wiley is very clear in where McKinney's sympathies lay. I'm not saying McKinney was a United Irishman as such, but he was certainly someone whose radical preaching had incurred the wrath of the authorities. Now, in 1796, autumn 1796, an advertisement appeared in the Northern Star. It was entitled A Seasonable and Necessary Information, and it was issued by the members of the Reformed Church called Presbyterian Dissenters, reproachfully called Mountain Men. This was the nickname, the unflattering nickname by which Covenanters were known in some areas. And the declaration says, "We hold in the highest abhorrence and detestation all tumultuous or disorderly meetings, and we utterly disclaim all connection with such, whether publicly or privately held, where anything is said or done that is prejudicial to the peace, safety or property of any individual or civil society." And that has been taken as a statement that the, in which the Covenanters are declaring their opposition to the United Irishmen, but possibly, maybe even probably not, in fact. First of all, it was published in the Northern Star. The Northern Star was the newspaper of the United Irishmen, and it's highly unlikely that an article critical of the United Irishmen would be published in the Northern Star. It may be that they're simply declaring their opposition or their revulsion at the general disorder in the countryside without any specific reference to the United Irishmen. Now, Gibson here in Currybackie was also someone who was coming under the suspicion of the authorities. Glasgow, in his history of the Reformed Presbyterian Church in America, writes, "His labours were signally blessed by the gathering of a large congregation, and in his fidelity to truth and the doctrine of Christ's headship over the church, he rendered himself obnoxious to a tyrannical government." Samuel McSkimmon's Annals of Ulster, Annals of Ireland, Ulster 50 years ago, writes that that Gibson preached the immediate destruction of the British monarchy to thousands across Antrim. Sprague, in his Annals of the American Church, wrote that he is said to have encouraged the private associations of the United Irishmen. Now, to what extent he was involved with the United Irishmen, we simply cannot be certain. But certainly in 1797, he finds himself in a situation where he's forced by a civil magistrate to take the oath of allegiance. As a Covenanter, he cannot do that. And so to preserve, no doubt preserve his own life, he flees to America. Now, when rebellion actually came in June 1798, to what extent Covenanters took part, we cannot be sure. We do know that the Clerk of Session of Knockbracken Reformed Presbyterian Church fought at the Battle of Ballinahinch in June 1798. You can see the drawing, the famous painting of the Battle of Ballinahinch. His name is James Witherspoon. He escaped the battle, went back to Knockbracken, but in 1803 he was part of a conspiracy to start a new rebellion in Ireland. Captured, arrested by the authorities, he's in prison for a time, and he's given the option of being released so long as he leaves the country. That happens. He goes to New York with his family in 1804. In the aftermath of the Battle of Ballinahinch, some soldiers returning from that battle to Belfast arrest Staveley, ransack his house, and for a time Staveley is imprisoned on a prison ship in Belfast Lough. Throughout that time he disclaims any involvement with the United Irishmen, denies completely that he was associated with them in any way. Eventually he is released with nothing proved against him. His treatment while he was arrested was pretty horrendous. He describes how they threatened to hack him, hang him, but he resisted any temptation to weaken and confess or give in. He stands firm. At the same time, in 1802, Staveley is censured by the Scottish Presbytery for his involvement with the United Irishmen, probably earlier in the 1790s, not necessarily at the time of the actual rebellion. He confesses that he had been a United Irishman, that he had initiated others into the United Irishman, and that he'd actually taken part in a planning for an arms raid. So Staveley was involved much more than maybe he was later prepared to admit. Some particular incidents arising from that. We sang from Psalm 52, which was a psalm sung before his execution by a young Covenanter in Mahara, and it's very much a felt to be him declaring his innocence and a very clear criticism of those who had accused him falsely of involvement in any seditious activities. Another incident that left its mark was the execution of Daniel English at Connor. English had been arrested and accused. It was widely believed that the evidence against him had been fabricated, but he was found guilty and marched from Ballymena to Connor and there hanged. The Reverend William Staveley accompanied him on that 4 mile walk, and huge numbers of people gathered at the roadside to watch what was happening. Some of them singing from Psalm 74, Psalm 76 and Psalm 119. It said that when he looked at the grave in which he was to be buried after his execution, he says, "A new grave in which no one has been buried before." And here at Cullibackie, we have an incident involving a James Giffen, not necessarily a Covenanter himself, but he sees an old man being beaten severely by an officer in the army, and he can't tolerate this, so what he does is offer himself to the officer, that he would take the place of the old man and he would receive the beating. The officer was so enraged at his impudence that he had him arrested, taken to Ballymena, and then he was brought back to Cullibackie and hanged on a tree just beside the Covenanter meeting house, just beside where we are now in front of his family. And then from the Armoy Church of Ireland Burial Register, finds things in all sorts of strange places, but in the Armoy Church of Ireland Burial Register in 1858, we have the burial of a John Ferris. And the entry in the burial register actually says, "Protestant dissenter of the Covenanters, a United Irishman in the rebellion of 1798, and twice narrowly escaped being hanged." Now, two young men worth mentioning in the context of the Covenanters in Cullibackie. Whenever Gibson left for America in 1797, he took two young men accompanied him. One was Samuel Brown Wiley, the other was John Black. Well, Wiley was born at Moylarg, just north of Ballymena. Educated at Glasgow, was the America 1797, ordained in America as a Reformed Presbyterian minister in Vermont in 1799. Becomes very involved in the anti-slavery campaign in America. Earlier than really any other denomination in America, certainly any Presbyterian denomination, the Covenanters take a very strong stand against slavery. As early as 1800, they make it a rule that no one could be a member of the Reformed Presbyterian Church if they owned a slave. And this really was quite radical. You know, this really was very different from the attitude of most religious denominations. So as early as 1800, no Covenanter could own a slave. If you did, you'd be excommunicated. And Wiley was very much involved in that campaign. Ministered in Philadelphia for nearly 50 years, from 1803 to 1852, and elected a member of the American Philosophical Society in 1806, professor of ancient languages, 1828 to 45, and vice provost, 1834 to 45, of Penn University. So in other words, not someone who, when he went to America, became a fringe figure, but someone who was right at the heart of it. Someone who was very much involved in public life and made a real impact in his new land. So, as I said, not a fringe figure, not someone in the backwoods, someone right at the heart of society in Philadelphia. The other young man was, as said, John Black. He was born in 1768 at Bracknamuckley, near Port Bunoan. Again, educated at Glasgow University. In the 1790s, he delivered lectures to societies of United Irishmen, in which he said to have spoken on the evils to which the country was subjected. As I've said, he goes to America in 1797, ministers in Pittsburgh from 1800 to 1849, and again, he's very much involved in society and very actively involved in the anti-slavery campaign. He's professor of Latin and Greek at Western University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of a book called The Bible Against Slavery, and he's described by Black and Wiley are described by Wiley's sons as ardent friends of liberty who took part in the United Irish movement at the risk of their lives. Now, Stavely, in the aftermath of the 1798 rebellion, finds himself very much at odds with his congregation at North Bracken. Certainly, the tension had arisen between them, arising from the events of the rebellion and the previous years. And Stavely withdraws as member of North Bracken, and in 1800 he becomes minister of Kelswater and Cullibackie. The RP Church grows in the early 19th century. I'll look in more detail at that next week. But to finish now with the fact that here in Cullibackie, on the 1st of May 1811, the first synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church was constituted. And being agreed beforehand that William Stavely would act as moderator. So when the synod gathered, Stavely was acting as moderator. And in a sermon to synod, he preaches on Hebrews chapter 3, verse 6. But Christ as a son over his own house, whose house are we, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end? We do know who was here at that first meeting of synod. I don't know how clear that is, but you can see that for the Northern Presbytery, for instance, William Stavely, Joseph Orr, William John Stavely, who was William Stavely's son, and then the vacant congregations at Ballyrasheen and Dunbow. And as far as elders are concerned, the elder representing Cullibackie and Kelswater was a Robert Sloan. The first synod brings together the four presbyteries. So now we have a Northern Presbytery, Western, Southern and Eastern Presbytery gathered together under a synod. So now we've, in a relatively short space of time, just a number of decades, we've gone from one minister to a first presbytery, which is dissolved, revived, and less than 20 years after the revival of the first presbytery, we have a synod, the Synod of the Reformed Presbyterian Church. And that is still today the ruling body within the church, the supreme ruling body within our denomination. To finish with a quote from Professor Adam Lockridge, the historian of the church. It was fitting that William Stavely, upon whose shoulders are rested so long the burden of leadership in the church, should be the first moderator of synod. He had served the church well when it was in a disorganized state from 1779 to 1792. Now he saw his work crowned with a program of expansion and organization that reached its climax with the constitution of the synod. So next thing what I'll be doing, we'll be looking at the history of Cullibackie since the beginning of the 19th century, from the beginning of the 19th century, and looking at the major developments in its history, bringing the story up to the present day. So thank you very much.